Tonight we're going to talk to some degree about Advaita. What does Advaita mean? Does everybody know what Advaita means? A-D-V-I-T-A? It means the non-dual science. That is, taking the principle that only God exists. Everything else is delusion and Maya. All these names and forms that we see are superimposed on the shining divinity by the mind. The mind being the manifestation of Maya. The mind, Maya when manifest, forms the mind. And the mind, in no time at all, creates all this varied world. But it's all delusion, all illusion, no matter how real it may seem. Because the reality, bottom line reality, when thorough investigation is made by the great sages, and when Swami himself looks at the situation, the reality is that there's only one, not two. So therefore, it's the science of non-duality. In India, there are some three schools. One school holds that God is real and eternal, but that man also is real and eternal, and that this eternal man and eternal God exist side by side, from the beginning of manifestation up to the very end. Swami said that is just a first move towards the science of non-duality. Now, see, to appreciate non-duality, you have to, in your minds, look at your arms and your knees and the people next to you and realize that all that is illusion. The person next to you doesn't really and truly exist. He or she is the manifestation of the Lord, the manifestation of Maya on the shining divinity, which is non-dual. Now, when the Maya, which hitherto has been unmanifest and unseeable in the divinity, when that Maya comes into manifestation, it is the mind. The mind is the manifestation of Maya. The mind then creates all these names and forms of the entire world. Now, the mind has two aspects. This aspect, where the mind sees this and sees that, and the I aspect, where the mind holds to the I thought. Now, that I thought then flourishes in the minds of people. It is very active all during the day, all during the variety of actions we have. We have the I feeling. The mind becoming aware of itself. That is, the person feeling that he exists, that I am, that I exist, comes into being, and then there arises body sensations. At the same time, the I concept comes into being. There arises body sensations, which the mind or the I conceit does not view as impersonal phenomena, but instead views those sensations from the body as I phenomena. Therefore, at the same time that I concept arises in the mind, the sensations of the body arise at the same time, and the I concept then declares that it is the body. The sensation of the body belong to I. And from that basic movement, the whole world comes about. Now, the scriptures say that the Lord took the five elements and mixed them up together in various combinations in order to manifest the world. But Yoga Vasishtha, that fantastic saint of the time of Rama, who knew through direct perception everything, was completely and totally free, told Rama that the reason for that statement in the scriptures was because if the scriptures said that you, the individual, creates the world, not God, then you would reject that finding and refuse to be guided. So that's why the scriptures seem to say one thing about the process, and the great Advaitic saints in direct communication say something quite else. Now, how is that going to play in one's daily life? See, Swami, when challenged, Swami, is the world real, or is it just Maya? Swami says, no, it's real, because underlying everything is God. Just as in the snake and the rope in India, the underlying rope is seen as snake. But nevertheless, snake is illusion. And when investigated, then what is revealed is the ever-existing rope, which was always there. And since the superimposition cannot be different than its substratum, then the ego, the I conceit, I am I, the ego, the I conceit, is really and truly not other than the shining divinity. Just as the snake is really not other than the rope. So, when one starts to search, to make spiritual inquiry into that situation, he finds that the self, the I conceit, the ego, seems to be real, and therefore he investigates its reality because it creates so much trouble. And upon investigating the reality of the superimposed I conceit, the person, the ego, it is found that its reality is God. And therefore, that is the reason that Swami has told you in a lecture some time ago that you should always keep in mind that I am God, I am Satchitananda, and so on. Now, the question then arises, If one says such things, I am God, I am Satchitananda, how does that ignorant self then change into the divine consciousness, which is the substratum? How does the change come about? Advaita tells us that the change comes about when we make inquiry. We listen to the indirect knowledge, which I'm repeating now. And then after having a good grasp on the indirect knowledge about the nature of the self and the nature of manifestation, then a person must reflect. That is, after having used his reason to investigate the knowledge about this phenomena, investigate it through the words of saints, investigate it through the words of Swami, and when a clear concept is gained of that indirect knowledge, then the devotee must trade that indirect knowledge for direct knowledge. That is, not that it is said that this lady is sitting here, which is indirect knowledge, but that I investigate and actually see that lady. She is sitting there. So, in that way, the mind, which in itself is false, brings into being the non-dual reality. How could a mind, which is in itself false, and which is the cause of all this tremendous misery in the world, which comes about through believing in the reality of name and form, how could come about? There, Swami says that just, not Swami, but the Advaita books, such as Yoga Vasishta, Ramana Maharshi, Shankaracharya, Astavakra, and others say that just as a wasp makes another wasp out of a grub, it takes the grub into its nest and stings the grub so severely that the grub holds nothing except its tormentor in its mind. And because it holds nothing but its tormentor in its mind, then it becomes the wasp. And it's the same way with ourselves. If we hold nothing but God in our minds, being clearly convinced, at least through indirect knowledge, that it seems very reasonable that God is the only reality, and that I am just name and form superimposed on that reality, then we are advised to take to the practice of always thinking of God, always have the mind fastened on God. Because just as the grub changes into the wasp, when the mind is fully concentrated on God, then the ego, which is none other than the self, just as the snake is none other than the rope, that the ego, which is none other than the self, will realize that it is the self. And therefore, liberation is achieved. And Swami, as I mentioned before, is insistent that now we must study this Advaita in two discourses in 1987. In both he said that from my 60th birthday, I have resolved that I will teach Advaita as the path of liberation. And if you'll from now on that you have some of the vocabulary and ideas, we'll go further, you watch Swami's statements very carefully. And you will be able to verify that to yourself in some of Swami's discourses. He said that we have passed through the stages of action and worship and have come to the stage of Advaita. We have left the lower schools and have entered college. In college, you do not study and play as children. Now you must take up the serious study of Advaita and master that science of non-dualism. Now, as I mentioned before, the study of Advaita is tied in very closely with devotion to God. I quoted Adi Shankara. Baba quoted Adi Shankara as saying that Adi Shankara taught this Advaita, this non-dual science. But in practice, at the level of action, he practiced devotion. And furthermore, we are told in the scriptures that the path of wisdom and the path of devotion, although being quite far apart for the beginner on the spiritual path, tend to come together closer and closer and closer and closer until eventually they are merged into one. They are merged into one in the action of the divine Adi Shankara, fully and completely liberated, yet in terms of daily action, the things we do every day, family, with our friends and so on, he practiced devotion. So therefore, we cannot give up devotion for the non-dual science, as many students of non-dual science feel they must do. Quite wrong. Indeed. Now, as of now, Advaita would be a new idea to most people here. It would seem very strange to say that you and the person beside you are just Maya and don't really exist at all. But you are seen through the eyes of Maya as the superimposition on the non-dual reality. Now, what is this non-dual reality on which everything is superimposed and which we aim to know ourselves as we go along in our spiritual practice? It can be defined in various ways. It's sometimes called the ether of consciousness. That is, the ether means the very finest of fine. Therefore, the very finest of fine of the consciousness. That is this non-dual reality. Or, looking at it another way, which perhaps is more easy to understand, we know that energy is prevalent every place. It's in the stars, it's in the space, the atoms in the space. Energy is in the earth. Energy is in our bodies. And energy is never destroyed. It just changes its form. So, that which is eternal, never changing its form, remaining always as it is energy. So you can look upon yourselves as divine manifestations of energy. Swami says that energy bubbles up into creation, the creation of name and form, and then merges back into energy. So, in thinking of yourself, and you're asking, what am I? Who am I? You are answering very truly if you say, I am energy. I don't say, I am Hyslop, but I am energy. And that energy which informs me is the same energy that informs you. Because if we come to each other and give each other a hug, it's very likely there'll be a transmission of energy between the two people. Energy comes from the stars in all sorts of waves and penetrates our bodies and our bones to the very infinite end of that phenomena. And it becomes part of the energy of the body. And therefore, the energy coming from the stars, from other people, and from everything, has its effect on you, because it impinges upon and adds to your energy system. Now that has a very strong implication for karma, that is the consequences of action. Because we like to think that we have free will. That's a fancy that everyone has. Now that fancy of free will always comes about after the incident, after the event. That is, something happens, and then we think, I could have done something different and changed the consequences. But the fact is that at the time, you acted. And only afterwards did the thought come up that I had free will and could have done something else. The fact is that you did the thing that you did. And that action that you did is brought about by all these streams of energy coming from the distant stars, coming from the earth, from plants, from animals, and from past karma. So, at any particular moment, we are totally and heavily conditioned by all sorts of things that we really don't even suspect the existence of, and don't bother even looking at them. So with all these streams of energy coming into ourselves and bringing about an action situation, how can we claim that we have free will? It's obvious we can't possibly have free will. Well then, what sort of a pickle does that leave us in? Well, I asked Swami about that. And he said that yes, it is true that from the viewpoint of God, there is no free will. See, I said to him, now, Swami, there'll be an army marching along a road, cross-passing a particular point. That particular point will be the present. And the people who have passed that point are the past, and the ones who are coming are the future. And so we deal in past, present, and future. But, Swami, if you are standing on a mountain and looking down at that line of soldiers in the valley, you see everyone at the exact same moment. You don't see something is present, something is past, something is future. You only see everything as being at this particular moment. So then, how can there be free will, Swami? And Swami replied, yes, from the standpoint of God, there is no free will. But from the standpoint of the human person, he must go about his assigned daily work and make decisions as though he had free will. Even though from God's standpoint there is no free will, yet you and I must make our choices and get into our actions based on the idea that we do have free will. But nevertheless, as students of spiritual science, we also have to know the actual situation. Now, that brings up the problem. If everything is the result of karma, then how can there be freedom? See, the past, present, and future are one. Everything is seen like that. There's no break in this wheel of action and reaction. And therefore, since there's no break in the wheel, how can we achieve liberation? Then, Swami's answer to that is, that despite all the factors which seem to negate the possibility of liberation, yet there has to be that possibility. Otherwise, the circle would be completely closed and there would never be anybody who attained liberation. So therefore, despite the overwhelming evidence that we are conditioned and act as conditioned persons, it is possible to break that cycle of karma and consequence. And Swami described how that is done. I forget if I told you this morning, but I'll tell you again anyway. And that is that it's well known to anybody who has a garden that if they plant flower seeds or vegetable seeds in the garden, then you have to be careful not to plant seeds too deep, because if they're planted too deep, they won't sprout. Everybody, I'm sure, knows that. Probably most of us do experience. So, Swami says it's the same thing with these seeds of karma, which will grow and flourish into many branches and many other seeds and keep us involved in karma over and over and over and over again. And he says that the way to break that cycle, that if you engage in seva, doing good actions for other people, being gracious and compassionate, and acting according to what seems appropriate, with no malice to anybody, but wishing to help everybody, then that seva is the earth which will bury the seeds of karma so deep that they cannot flourish and come above the ground. They will die under that deep burial of good deeds and good thoughts done. So therefore, almost everybody worries about the vast hill of karma behind him, where it will take us at the next birth. Yet, Swami says that if we follow his instructions and do seva, goodwill to everybody, then those seeds of karma will be buried, and those seeds of karma will not flourish at all. Now, taking the matter a step further, our objective in making this inquiry, the inquiry into Advaita, the inquiry into how our mind works, so as to try and arrive at the truth. That inquiry will bring us to the point where there can be a sudden and complete change in ourselves. Because if you look at the snake and the rope and ask yourself the question, was there ever in this world a case where the rope appeared as a snake, and when investigated, it was not found that rope was the only reality? Now, obviously, that never occurred. Anybody investigating can lay open the truth. So, it's the same way then with this Advaita. We investigate within ourselves by subtle thought, by watching ourselves. Because our only reality is that inner self that is permanent. And therefore, you can't find about that by investigating the body and thinking that the vegetarianism alone will take you to liberation, and so on. It doesn't happen that way. You have to actively investigate. Now, how can man, you and I, make that deep investigation? Swami says that there are four things which differentiate man from animal. And The first one of those is that man has the power to reason things out. See, when you hear that everything that you see is Maya, illusion, and that only God exists really, then you have the power as a man to look at that statement, that indirect information, and with your subtle mind, reason it out, and arrive yourself at a hypothesis, which is the best that you can do. And then once the hypothesis is there, then you investigate that, going right down to its very roots. Now, the second characteristic that man has that animals do not have is the ability to know the difference between right and wrong. Animals really can't know that difference. But man has the ability to know the difference between right and wrong. Therefore, man has the ability, through subtle reasoning and distinguishing between right and wrong, has the ability to completely transform himself. That is the third human aspect. The animal cannot transform itself. They could have a meeting in the forest and declare that I, as the elephant, am going to transform myself into the lion. And the lion says, I am going to transform myself into the elephant. Now, that's not possible. Animals cannot transform themselves, but man, with a subtle intellect and with the right energy and the correct idea of learning, can completely transform himself from the faulty human being into the perfect expression of divinity. Man has that power to transform himself from this human being into something completely different, a divinity. And then man has a fourth power that animals do not have. And that fourth power is the power to get free from Maya. Animal can never free himself from the Maya of name and form. But man has the ability to free himself from Maya and then see things as they really and truly are. Now, if we pursue this inquiry, where we read books on Advaita, listen to those who speak on Advaita, then use our own subtle reasoning to reason through the whole thing and arrive at a tenable hypothesis, then we have to move still further in order to move from a indirect knowledge to a direct knowledge. That is, that oneself has to see and observe directly, face to face, so to speak, that the self is not really veiled and thus unable to shine forth. Not really veiled, and thus making these Mayic impositions on the substratum, that actually something can be done about the mind, which creates all of this phenomena. Your mind. Mind creates the world. Your mind creates your world. What do you know about your world? All you know about your world is that you have some sensations arising because the sense organs touched the sense objects. And that contact carried its message to the brain. And the brain, the mind, then through the use of memory, and hearsay, then assumes that these signals from the sense organs are genuinely apperceived, and then we project the world outside. That is, the world that we interpret to be in existence because of the sensory signals reaching our mind. That world is then projected to the outside. Now, the proof of that is that in dreams, the entire dream world is not different from the dreamer. That is, at the end of a dream, do we exit the dream world, close the door, and go back in tomorrow night? No, we don't. As soon as we waken up, we know directly that everything that occurred in the dream was made up of our mind, ourself, including the body that we identified as ourself, and including all the other bodies in the dream, enemies and friends, all the buildings, all the actions, and with never a question as to their authenticity. Nothing is too crazy for the mind to project and see as outside reality. Conceive that. We absolutely know through our own direct experience. This is what is meant by using your subtle reasoning. Through your own direct experience, you know that the dream world, which you go into when you sleep, but haven't gone into deep sleep, that dream world and everything in it, including the buildings, the cars, the animals, the events, the body we identify as by ourselves, the whole thing is made out of mind stuff and then projected out on the world. Now, Swami tells us that the waking dream is the same. That when the mind is formed, it is the depository and the playground of all the past tendencies and trends, concepts, and emotions. These tendencies from the past then proliferate in the mind and are projected as this world. So therefore, the only way to stop this false world from being seen by us and giving us so much trouble is to have all mental activity cease. That is, the mind must become completely silent. Silence is the same as liberation. It's just another word for liberation. The mind must become completely silent. Now, when the mind, through practice, through inquiry, through subtle reasoning, when you see the whole layout of how things come into being, then the mind can stop its activity. And when the mind stops its activity, then the world, the people, and God all disappear, have no relevance. All Maya, they all disappear entirely. And the outer mind is destroyed. Now, Swami has said, in fact, he told the story of King Janaka, when Astavakra, the young boy sage with eight twists in his spine, Janaka went to him and asked him to show him the secret of liberation. And so Astavakra told King Janaka, very well, King, But this is a very, very valuable thing. And to secure something of great value, you must give something of great value. Certainly I can do what you ask, but you must give me something of great value. King Janaka said, "Astrabhakra, I am known far and wide through India as a man of my word. My word is never broken. So therefore, I tell you now that whatever you ask of me, I will give you." Astavakra then said, "Very well, O king, give me your mind." And the king gave Astavakra his mind. And Astavakra said, "Sit there, don't move." Astavakra then went into the forest and sat at the bole of a tree. And very soon the king's courtiers came and were extremely worried to find their king in such an odd position, sitting in the dirt in the middle of the road. And when they talked to him, he wouldn't say anything to them. So then they sent for the queens from their palaces, and the queens came to persuade King Janaka to say something, just completely impervious to anything that was said. Then the courtiers got worried to think, "This Astavakra, he has cast a spell over our king. Let us go and find him." So they went into the forest and found Astavakra sitting at leisure, enjoying the quiet at the foot of a tree. And they said, "O sage, you have cast a spell upon our king. He won't say anything. He won't make any movement." And Astavakra said, "Nonsense. There is no spell on your king. Here, I will come with you." So he came then and said to Janaka, "Janaka, speak to your queens." So then Janaka spoke to his queens. And then he said, "Janaka, get up." So Janaka got up. "Now, Janaka, put your foot in the stirrup and ride your horse back to the palace." At the moment of putting his foot in the stirrup and swinging his leg over the saddle, King Janaka gained a complete liberation. That is, he had given his mind to Astavakra. It surrendered his mind. He no longer had a mind. Now, that mind which was surrendered is the mind of form. There are two minds. There is the form mind and the formless mind. When the form mind is destroyed, then complete silence comes upon the mind. Because in the destruction of the form mind, all of the vasanas or tendencies which create the world disappeared along with the destruction of the form mind. So then the only thing that the realized person then knows, he has direct, immediate knowledge of the self, of Satchitananda. Satchitananda is the manifestation of the Absolute. Swami says that when out of the bottomless abyss of the Absolute, the Lord manifests himself, he can be discerned as Satchitananda, directly seen. Therefore, the liberated man sees Satchitananda directly and is filled with the bliss of realizing the self, filled with bliss. Forgotten, the world is complete. He is completely free. He is completely immersed in the bliss of the self. Now, the formless mind cannot be destroyed as long as the body persists. And you've read someplace in your literature, I'm sure, that the person cannot live longer than 8 or 12 days, or something like that, because he can't take food, he can't take drink, he's completely gone from every aspect of the life. Then he can't even feel the bliss of the self, because he is the self. Cannot feel it in terms of somebody feeling the bliss, because That's the action of duality. Then he is that bliss. He is that absolute. So, that is the general process about which we are speaking. Now, the mind has to become completely silent. So the Vedic sages tell their disciples, forget everything and be like a rock or a stone. Don't think of anything. Make the mind completely silent. Now that's what was told to Lord Rama. And Rama responded, Vasishtha, then I would be insentient, like the rock or the piece of wood. And Vasishtha replied, not at all. You will be like waking sleep. Your intellect will be superlatively sharp. You will know everything. You will not be like a rock. Then the question is asked, but Lord, why should I forget everything? Then the response is that you should forget everything because everything is Maya. Everything that you know now is Maya. So you must not hold on to that Maya. Just forget everything about yourself, about the world, about everything, because it's all Maya. So forget it. And that is the only way to reach this position of direct knowledge of the self. Now, Swami also says there that he has, you know, I asked him, Swami, these people that we talk about, we hear about, Astavakra, King Janaka, and so on, they're all old-timers, you know, born hundreds and hundreds, thousands of years ago, maybe. That's all in the past. Is there anybody, Swami, in this present day and age who has achieved complete silence of the mind and the full realization of the self? Swami says, oh, yes, quite a number of them, many people. But he said that these people never show themselves. If they're not up in the Himalayas and are down on the valley of India, moving around, they avoid all gatherings. And if you should see one and trace him, he would manage to avoid you and not even speak to you. Because you have to do it. He can't do it for you. Then I said, well, Swami, that's Mother India, where all these things happen. Is it possible that there are people like that, fully self-realized, in the Western world today? So I said, oh, yes. Yes, yes, many. So I said, well, Swami, they don't shine forth. We don't see them. We don't know who they are. And Swami said, no. They take great pains to remain invisible and unknown. But nevertheless, in this very day and age, even in the Western world, there are people like that. Now, the process which I have described, which will seem so useless and far-fetched that it's of no practical value to you at all, is nevertheless the path that every person in this room and every person in the world must eventually follow. Every person in the world eventually must take that path and achieve liberation. No matter how many times he falls by the wayside, he will get up and move onward and will reach the goal. So that holds for us in this room. Whether we concede the idea or not, that is the course of events which will take place. Now, Swami also looks at it in another way by talking about the process of evolution. You know, Swami, up in his room at night time, he writes and writes and writes. And people who are in his room tell us that there are volumes of writings which the ants have eaten up and will never see the light of day. Well, one day, about 14, 15 years ago, Swami brought down one of these books. And Gokak was there, and my wife and I were there, and one other person. And so then Swami would say the writing in Telugu, and Gokak would then translate it into English. And what he was doing, Swami, was showing, displaying the path of evolution from the mineral up to the divine, stage by stage. Now, we did that for two afternoons only. Then Swami didn't like Gokak's translation. He didn't think that Gokak was doing the correct job. So I'll be darned if he didn't fold up his book and take it back upstairs. And we never got anything else out of that wonderful book. But then Swami told me later what this process of evolution was. He said that the jiva, or the individualized being, starts with the granite, with the rock. And in time, evolves into the vegetable with a quantum jump. That is, you don't find a hybrid vegetable and animal. The evolution takes place in a quantum jump from one to the other. Then as ages go on, there's another quantum jump of this jiva from the vegetable kingdom to the animal kingdom. And then, after ages have passed, there's another quantum jump from the animal to the human. Now, that takes place very often because we eat animals. And it is because we eat the animals that the animal becomes part of our body and becomes a human. Now, he said, that now comes the very, very difficult aspect of evolution. Because a man must transcend his humanity and go to the next stage of Superman, from man to Superman. Now, in India, when you're staying there a long time, you encounter yogis, and you hear stories about these yogis walking on water, walking through the mountainside, levitating and going long distances in the air, and so on. All these siddhi powers. So I said to Swami, Swami, these people who live up in the Himalayas and are able to do all these things, are they the Superman? And Swami said, no, no. They are just ordinary people trying to get liberation. So then I said, well, Swami, who then is the Superman? And then Swami quoted some very ancient sages, like Vashishta and I can't think of the names now, all that were in my tongue. But anyway, quoted the names of some sages of very ancient times and said, these people were Superman. But I said, Swami, what does that mean, Superman? They're on a different stage than the human entirely. They're now Superman. What is Superman? What is the difference? Swami said, the difference is that the Superman has totally finished with the human evolution, has no more attachments whatsoever to anything in the world or anything having to do with the human evolution. The only time that these ancient sages would speak or act would be for the benefit of mankind. They had absolutely no desire, no benefits for themselves whatsoever. So that is the stage of Superman. Now, next comes the stage of the Spirit. That would be number 8, I think. And so I asked Swami, in the stage of the Spirit, Swami, that evolution process, are there people, recognizable personalities? Swami said, no, not really. There are just currents of spiritual energy. And then, of course, the final step is to the cosmic, which we know is union with the absolute, union with the Swami. So those are the steps of evolution that you and I and all life on earth go through. To just then briefly review before you start to ask questions. Advaita is the study of the non-dual reality. The non-dual reality is the only reality. Everything else is Maya. All our lives are comprised of Maya. Our sole task in life is to perceive and to penetrate the veil of Maya so that we may know our own true nature. Now, the veil of Maya is penetrated by spiritual inquiry. That is, you're told intellectually that Maya covers the self, that there are 5 sheaths in the body, 3 bodies, the physical body, the subtle body, and the causal body. Now, the physical body is the food body, which we all know. The subtle body is known as the mind. And the mind, then, in joining with sensation and with anger and possessiveness and seeing things as distinct from itself, objects outside of itself, is the subtle body. Now, the sheaths cover the self. It's like the physical body is like a sword in a sheath. The sheath hides the sword. You can't see the sword or know its nature. So you have to penetrate that sheath in order to perceive and understand the sword. So likewise, with the subtle body, which is the this aspect of mind, combined with the emotions, and the second body in the subtle body is the mental sheath. The mental sheath demonstrates and objectifies all of the tendencies that we are born with and projects them to the outside world as objects in the outside world, just as we do in the dream state. Then the third sheath in the subtle body is the intellectual sheath. Now the intellectual sheath is concentrated on the I idea. It declares that I am, a person, identifies itself with the life in the body as the body, identifies itself with the life in the body as the body. That is the ego. And that is the intellectual sheath. Now this intellectual sheath and the mental sheath and the subtle sheath, they are the remnants. They are the aspects of the person which carry all the seeds of karma. And they migrate to other bodies and are born and reborn. The subtle body. Now we come to the causal body. See, the causal body is like this. Everyone has the experience of slipping away from dreams into deep sleep. And then we awaken and say, I didn't know anything, but I was happy. Is that right? And you wake up from real deep sleep. Oh, you would like to go right back there. Because you were happy and ignorant. Ignorant completely of everything, but nevertheless, you come back and say, I was happy. Even though the memory is gone, and you can't remember the mind during that, yet nevertheless, the ego in subtle form enters into the deep sleep and remembers its experience of joy and ignorance, and then comes back and tells its story. Now, that causal sheath, which is that ignorance. See, it is said that this whole world, this whole universe, manifests from ignorance. And therefore, that ignorance of Maya is called the causal body, because the ignorance causes all the rest of the phenomena. Now, the process is that as time goes on, and we start to look into these things seriously, perhaps get a hold of some books on Advaita, study them, see how they apply to you, then what is you start to do is to actually experience the five sheaths with the subtle reasoning, realizing that you, the self, are not any of those sheaths. The sheaths exist, and they act as a veil where you cannot shine forth, but actually they are non-self, and they are viewed by the self, who is the witness. So then by subtle reasoning, you work your way through the five sheaths and realize that at the bottom of the five sheaths, what remains is the absolute. And then silence of the mind comes about, and you have achieved liberation. Now, that's also complicated. Maybe I've said enough about that, and should now open for any kind of question. Remember what Swami said, that questions are of supreme importance, because they represent the points of confusion, and by clearing up one aspect of confusion, we answer the same problem in many different minds. So any questions about anything at all? The absolute is the formless energy. God is Ishvara. So not in the Indian mythology, God is referred to as Ishvara. But Ishvara, the world, and man are all equal. All are Maya. And when the truth is seen, all disappears. The only thing that remains then is yourself as the self. Advaita says that the meditation that you undergo now in your ignorant state has the benefit of giving rest to the overactive mind. But it will not free you. You may experience God in the light meditation. Swami says that at some time or other, without any provocation from you, the meditator will disappear, the object of meditation will disappear, and the process of meditation will disappear, and God only exists. So meditation, which has the objective of subtly finding out the truth of the five sheaths and exposing the self, comes about later on, when you have thoroughly assimilated the indirect knowledge and have gained some direct knowledge, and then you want to verify it by personal experience. Then you do the search in meditation. I used to be a theosophist. In fact, in the very early days, when Annie Besant chose Krishnamurti, they were living in Aryavihara in the Ojai Valley. And Fritz Kunz, his wife is now the president of the Theosophical Society, I was field secretary to Fritz Kunz, and so was with the Krishnamurti for 2 years, almost solidly. So the masters, Swami has said, exist just as you exist, but they're no more real than you are. Next question? No, the experience of the bliss is when Sat Chidananda is directly experienced. And that is directly experienced with the death of the form mind. Then you feel the bliss of Satchitananda. But later on, when the formless mind disappears, then you sink into the ocean and no longer experience that direct bliss. You are the ocean then. It says that to hold on to individuality is totally impossible. The goal cannot be achieved without completely abandoning your individuality. Next question.
We are driven by desire.
Yeah.
And why should we desire liberation?
Oh, no reason. No reason at all. You can enjoy the world for the next 2 million years. No problem. It's only when the interest arises in you that something happens. You know, if everybody were liberated tomorrow, the game would be over, wouldn't it? Next question. We don't recapitulate the truth constantly because we still haven't got sufficient interest. It's not the driving interest in our life. The world, the family, the job, the business, the enjoyments are still the driving force. That's the only reason. Any question? You see, Swami says that that whole process of evolution is Maya also. It's like school. You pass an examination, then you can go to the next grade. But people don't have to go to school. You can just short-circuit that entire process of evolution by fixing your mind on God. Next question. See, he says, what is the purpose of creation? First of all, the purpose of creation existed before creation. First comes the purpose, then comes the creation. So how can creation know anything which is totally outside of us? It's like going to see the inner sanctum of a temple, and you have very, very nice shoes. But you find that you have to leave your shoes outside the inner sanctum. The shoes cannot view and enjoy the inner sanctum. And in the same way, the manifest mind cannot know what is behind its creation. In order to understand creation, you must become the creator. And that's the whole object of this sadhana. Become the creator. You see, Swami says one general thing, and that is that for all of these questions that arise, and very legitimately arise, we don't doubt that at all. I have a number of questions myself I continue to pose to Swami. But Swami says, and so do the Vedic sages, that the thing to do is find the self. Then ask questions about the world. See? Because everybody knows that his self exists. Everybody knows I am. So, why not stay with that I and trace it to its source? And then experience the source. And then if the question still persists, ask the question. You see, on the greater side of it, creation is Maya. Swami says that just as the bubbles arise by their own volition from the bottom of the sea and rise to the surface, so likewise Maya, most mysteriously, of its own volition, rises from the absolute and foliates most luxuriantly. Now, people continue to demand, what's the meaning of creation? So Swami obliges with various statements. For example, he has said, I was lonely, and I wanted company, and various things like that. But those are for children, are they not? How many more questions, Steve? One more? Can one person interfere with another person's journey to liberation? You see, the answer there has to be no, not really. because the trip from where we are now to liberation is from the self to the self, inside the self, from the self to the self. It's an inner journey, but no one else sees. Swami says, it is totally impossible for any person to judge their own spiritual progress. They should not attempt that. And it is equally impossible for any person to judge and know the spiritual progress of another person. He says further, he asked me in one meeting, he said, Hislop, why is it that people are unhappy? So I went back to the primer and said, well, Swami, because they don't surrender to God. And so I said, yes, 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 I know, Hislop, but not that. No. He said, people are unhappy because they don't live in the moment. They don't live moment to moment. He says, let every moment be itself, and then drop it, and meet the next moment, and drop that, and the next moment. Now, there was a lady in Colorado whose husband is an engineer who makes frequent trips to China to build industrial plants, and she goes with him. And she then, when her husband is working, takes a tour organized by the Chinese government. And on this particular tour, there was one of the tour guides living from the clothes in very miserable condition and yet always cheerful and happy. And so this lady asked, how is it living in these miserable conditions that you are always so optimistic and happy? And this Chinese girl in the middle of China, all the way in the middle of China, said, well, because I live in the moment, not drowned by the sufferings of the past or by the worries of the future. I just live moment to moment. And if other people knew that secret, they also would be happy. A great philosopher in the middle of rural China. One topic that is on everybody's mind is surrender to the Lord. And I notice that it comes up again and again, just what does surrender mean, and how does one surrender to the Lord? It has a different meaning entirely than the military term surrender. That is, a soldier surrenders and he gives his freedom and his armament to the enemy. That is, something is given, something is taken, and therefore he surrenders. But surrender to God is not in that same category. When surrender to God has occurred, when we realize that only God exists, that there is nothing else except God, and then the question of surrender has no meaning. It doesn't even arise, because there is nothing that is real except God himself. Now, how does one apply that principle in daily life? Well, if I may be forgiven for giving an example from myself, I do appreciate, after all these years, that all this vast panorama of name and form is transient, arises and disappears, arises and disappears. Even the most permanent of things, such as mountains and oceans and so on. And so, I am quite able to accept the fact that God is the only reality, and that all else is Maya. So, everything that I do, I say, Lord, thy will be done. We're building a house in Tijuana now, running into all sorts of difficulties with the corrupt officialdom of Mexico. You had no idea the troubles that arise. But I doesn't bother me at all, because I realize that in a program like that, there's all sorts of karmas intertwined. The karmas of the individuals, the karmas of the architect, the karma of the builder, and so on. And I really haven't any idea how that will turn out. So I simply say to myself, Lord, thy will be done. If it is thy will that this house be built, fine. If it turns out that thy will is that the house does not be built, fine. I accept it. Swami himself gives us that lead as to how we should carry out our daily life. He says, the Hub himself, that I always say, yes, yes, yes. That is, he accepts everything. Yes, yes, yes. So that is surrender to God. Taking everything that happens as God's will, let God be the doer. In India they say, it's somewhat similar, why don't you do like the first class passengers do on the train? Get on the train, go to your compartment, let the guard lock the door, and go to sleep. Leave everything up to the guard. When the time comes, when your station arrives, he'll come and unlock the door, and you'll get off at your station. So our lives, according to the sages, should be like that. Let God do all the work. Swami says, I will do everything. Leave it to me. I will do everything. I will protect you. We are children of God. And as children of God, we have the right to ask for anything. And we may get it or not, according to God's judgment as to whether or not it's appropriate for us. I was telling some friends this illustration just the other day that I knew a lady in Singapore. And she was quite innocent. And she said to Swami, you know, in her mind, Swami, I want to go to Puttaparthi, but I don't have tickets. I haven't any money. In about 3 weeks' time, with the mail comes two tickets to Puttaparthi. Not the slightest idea where they come from. Then a little later, she wanted $5,000 to make an initial donation to a new charity in Singapore. And she said, Swami, I want to make this $5,000 donation, but I don't have any money. And so, lo and behold, in 2 or 3 weeks, there comes a check through the mail for $5,000. Check is good. She'd know who it came from. No idea whatsoever. So that's one way of approaching God, which we have the right to do, to demand of Him as our Divine Father whatever we want. Now the other approach is the approach of surrender. That is, whatever God chooses to do, we accept. And don't worry about it. Each moment for itself, says Swami, each day for itself, each week for itself. In that program, the thing to do is let every moment go. Now this moment comes and you're full of thoughts and worries and ideas. Let it go. Just drop it and let the next moment come. And that is the way that Swami himself defines a surrender to God. So if we have a couple of questions, I'd be glad to answer. Yes, of course, we all have preferences. We can't help but have preferences because all the past incarnations have built in certain tendencies in us, and those find flower in desires and cravings and preferences. So we observe those happening, but don't identify with them. You see, when a preference arises of which you are aware, now there has to be somebody who is conscious of that preference. There has to be somebody who knows that preference. There has to be somebody who observes that preference arising. Isn't that right? See? Well then, you are the observer. You are not the preference. The preference is something from outside. Some tendency you put on your shoulder from past lives. But you are not that preference. You are the observer. So therefore, disassociate yourself from anything that you can observe. The observer is always separate and distant from the observed. So therefore, you feel the preference is, oh, there's that preference. But Lord, I surrender everything to thee. Like that. Okay. Sat on.